What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, you probably heard yesterday, Phil Spector, the music producer behind some of pop music's greatest hits, such as Be My Baby by the Ronettes and John Lennon's Imagine, the creator of his groundbreaking wall of sound, has died aged 81 while serving a prison sentence for murder. Media reports say Spector, who'd been sentenced to 19 years to life for murdering the actor Lana Clarkson, died after being diagnosed with COVID-19 4 weeks ago. Joining us now on News Talk to look at the man behind the wall is Mick Brown, journalist with The Telegraph and author of Tearing Down the Walls of Sound, The Rise and Fall of Phil Spector. Good afternoon, Mick. How are you today?
Good afternoon, Tom. Very well, thank you.
I don't know if you were following the outbreak on social media yesterday about his death. It was remarkably unsympathetic. People were, you know, they were talking about the death of an evil man, and there wasn't a kind word being said.
Yeah, I'm sort of slightly taken aback by that. I mean, I can understand it, of course, because he was a convicted murderer and he committed a terrible crime and he should be and will always be remembered for that. But at the same time, he was a musical genius. He made wonderful records. He brought happiness into millions of people's lives, and I think it's fitting that that should be recognised too. I think you can be a tortured genius and a murderer at the same time. You know, the two things aren't mutually exclusive.
Absolutely. You got to interview him. You got the first interview with him, I think, after something like 25 years. And I think, was it the last interview he did before events, the event with Lana Clarkson unfolded?
That's right. Yeah, I interviewed him at his home, this extraordinary Pyrenees castle, so-called, that he lived in Los Angeles. And I interviewed him at the end of December 2002. And 5 weeks later, my piece appeared on the cover of the Telegraph magazine, Found Pop's Lost Genius. And that was the Saturday. And on the Sunday night, Los Angeles time, he was out cruising around and picked up Lana Clarkson, who was the VIP greeter at this nightclub, the House of Blues, and took her back to his home and killed her there, where I'd interviewed him 5 weeks earlier. So it was quite a shocking juxtaposition of events, really.
My word. To go back to the interview, it seems like it was surreal. You were picked up in a Rolls Royce with, you know, a Phil 500 registration on it, brought off the house. How surreal was it?
Completely surreal. It made even more surreal by the fact that I'd been told to wait for a phone call in my hotel and came down and there was the Rolls Royce. And I got into this Rolls Royce with an immaculately attired chauffeur, and he turned the ignition and the car wouldn't start, by which point a crowd had gathered around the car to see who it was getting into it. Nobody interesting, I had to explain. But we had to get a taxi, come over and connect jump lead so that he'd get the car started again. But we eventually got to the castle. And I was told to get out at the foot of a very, very long flight of steps, which I had to walk up through these sort of lowering pine trees. Went into the house and waited for a half an hour, and he finally arrived, came down the stairs, dressed in a black silk pajama suit with his initials PS monogrammed in silk on the chest, wearing a curled Louis the 15th curled shoulder length toupee, blue tinted glasses, and his Cuban heels, bringing him up to a height of 5'7". And we sat down, and almost the first question I asked him was how are you? Expecting just a exchange of pleasantries, and he said, I've not been well. And this was the prelude to an extraordinarily candid interview where he talked about all the mental difficulties that had assailed him over his life. He said, I have demons inside. I'm not schizophrenic, but I take medication for schizophrenia. He told me that his parents were first cousins, and he'd always wondered through his life whether that might have had something to do with his with his mental condition. He diagnosed himself as being bipolar, and he was clearly on medication at that time. He told me he was on various medications. But it was an extraordinary interview where he talked about that, but also, of course, at the same time talked about working with Lennon, working with George Harrison, the Beatles, the Ronettes. I mean, the history of pop music, really, from the 1950s, because he'd had his first hit in the late 50s when he was 16 years of age. If he hadn't actually worked with, he'd known everybody in the music business, and he'd become the power in the music business for a period between 1962, say, and 1965. He was the most successful and probably the most important individual in pop music, and this for a producer, not an artist, for a producer, because the records he made were much bigger than the artists who made them, if that makes sense.
His production skills were also on the end of severe bashing on Twitter yesterday, and I felt a bit aggrieved about that. To try and explain to people what it was he did, this so-called wall of sound, what was that and why was it so groundbreaking?
At the time, in the late 50s, early 60s, recording techniques in the studios were very primitive compared to today. So everything was recorded on one or at most two tracks. And the standard sort of setup, as it were, for a rock record, pop record, was a guitar, drums, bass, maybe a sax player, maybe a pianist. So the sound was relatively thin. Spector, I mean, he loved music. He had an encyclopedic knowledge of all kinds of music, but he particularly liked classical music. And he wanted to make pop records that replicated something of the grandeur and something of the scale and something of the majesty of classical symphonies. But he couldn't do that with a small group that he was working with. So what he would do is he would have, in this small cramped studio in Los Angeles, Gold Star Studios, he would have maybe five guitarists all hunkered around the microphones, and he'd go from one to the next whispering, play it dumb, play it dumb. He just wanted them all to play the same chord over and over and over again. He had three guys playing the piano. He had two drummers. He had a sax player, other brass. He might have a string section in there. And then he had a choir of backing singers, one of whom was Cher, who got her first break singing backup for Phil Spector. And then add on to that all the percussion that you could possibly cram into the studio, timbales, tambourines, triangles, you name it, he had it there. Then all of this would be fed into an echo chamber, and what you would get at the end of it would be something, a pop record that replicated something of the scale and grandeur of a symphonic record. And this is what he called them. He called them little symphonies for the kids. That's what he wanted to do.
And the end result is very euphoric, very exciting. And it blew people away. Like Brian Wilson was hugely impressed by all this.
Brian Wilson would go and sit in the studio watching Spector work, like a sort of disciple at the feet of a prophet. I met Brian Wilson subsequently, and he told me that he thought that Be My Baby was the most important pop record ever made, and that he'd actually begin the day every day by playing Be My Baby. That was the impression that it made on him. If you listen to the early Bruce Springsteen records, particularly Born to Run, that's just torn straight out of the Phil Spector copybook. So Spector really revolutionized the sound of pop records, as well as being successful. But he was also he did everything. He co-wrote them, he produced them. He had his own record label, so he marketed them. He took on the record industry single-handedly, really, and became, in Tom Wolfe's famous phrase, you know, the first tycoon of teen. You know, I mean, he was a millionaire by the time he was 19, 20, completely in charge of his own ship. And I think a lot of that occasioned a lot of resentment in the record industries. The short-armed, cigar-chomping fatties, as he would call them, you know, the guys that at that point controlled the music business in America. And suddenly there's this weird upstart character with weird looks and weird hair who isn't playing the game, who doesn't want to be part of the gang. So he was, from a very early age, he was resented and admired. But as he said to me, a lot of people might have hated me, but you have to say that everybody who ever worked with me made money from it. And that's probably right. True.
Well, I hope no one steps, tries to take the pop genius tag off him, because those records are absolutely remarkable in my view. But also, and simultaneous to the records, his behaviour was already very, very strange. Was it the way he treated Ronnie, almost keeping her a prisoner in their own house? That was remarkably strange behaviour.
Oh, he was a very strange man. I mean, I came to the conclusion in after interviewing him and then writing the book, which I did, that he was an unwell man from a very, very early age. And it was well known in the music business that he had a predilection for guns. It was well known that he had a predilection. His father had died when he was 9. And I think having been the sort of the lonely boy in his bedroom, as it were, the small runty guy who nobody really wanted to be friends with, he'd built up this tremendous sort of resentment against the world. And I think in a way, once he discovered that music was his gift, that became his revenge on the world. But he didn't like people to leave. And there were countless stories that I was told about people who would go and see him in the mansion in Beverly Hills where he was living at the time, and the time would come for them to leave. It's 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. And he'd say, I don't want you to go. And the door's locked, you can't leave. And so there'd be this protracted negotiation before they could actually get out. And in the case of women, and sometimes men, but more often women, then a gun would appear and he'd start waving a gun around and threatening them. And as you say, yes, the situation with Ronnie was that he, having married her, this jewel that he craved, and he wanted to keep it in the box. And he was very possessive, very jealous, and very, very oppressive.
Wow. Well, he leaves behind some amazing records, but God, his life was such a car crack and brought such awful devastation on people. And obviously the murder of Lana Clarkson and all that the pain and hurt that would bring on her family. It's a mixed bag. Mike, thank you very much for that today. Thanks for talking to us, Lee. That was Mike, the author of Tearing Down the Wall of Sound, The Rise and Fall of Phil Spector.
Moncrief on News Talk.